This is Tim Murdoch. You're watching Endgame Exotica, exclusive interview series to White Rabbit Radio. Today we have on a returning guest, highly acclaimed from Australia, famous Australian nationalist. There's a handful, and he's one of them, Joel Davis. How you doing, sir?
Hey, man. Nice to be on again.
It's always good to have you on. What time is it down there? It is 6 o'clock on a Monday evening here. What is it? It's like 8? Is it 8 a.m. yet on a Tuesday?
On Tuesday.
It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday?
Mm.
Okay, so you're 14 hours ahead. Always got to get that straight. Scheduling Australians is always tricky. Australians and South Africans. But there's a lot of exciting stuff going on over there. A lot of crazy stuff. I noticed that, I continue to watch Noticer because if it happens in Australia and it's relevant, it's generally the Noticer picks it up. I thought this was a wild poll, though, and I know you've seen this. 7 in 10 Aussies want welcome to country ceremony stop completely. What do you make of these large numbers? Is it the
same? In that poll, by the way, for the 23% said that they want them significantly reduced. So, But, for Americans, you might not even know what a so-called welcome to country is.
Yes, tell us.
Let me explain it to you. Imagine if someone from the local Native American tribe was wheeled out at every single public event and paid like 10 grand to stand there and welcome you to the traditional lands of whatever the Native American tribes people were, and then give you a lecture about how it's their land and they never ceded sovereignty to the American Republic. And then all the politicians stood around and clapped and talked about how it's one of the oldest cultures in the world and how much they respect the Native Americans. And then imagine there was a Supreme Court decision that stated that it was illegitimate that America was ever settled by the American people, and that basically all the forestry and lands and so on that are owned by the government could basically be seized and claimed through the courts by local Native Americans. And then at this point, 80 to 90% of the territory of the United States was being claimed in this way. In active court cases, and that this was considered completely normal and reasonable, and that if you complained about it, you're a racist. That's basically, an analogy of what's happening. So every football game, every basketball game, every baseball game, every government address. And then imagine you have Veterans Day. In Australia, Anzac Day is like our Veterans Day, but it's actually, I think, maybe we celebrate it more intensely than Americans celebrate Veterans Day. In Australia, Anzac Day is one of the biggest holidays of the year. It's more important to us than Australia Day, which is our equivalent of, I guess, like Independence Day for Americans.
To me, Anzac Day is a lot like Independence Day in America, as far as how big the celebration is in Australia.
Yeah, but it's not so much a celebration. It's more of a kind of reverent, like religious day, basically thinking, doing a ceremonies commemorating the sacrifice of Australian soldiers who fought, now particularly in World War One and World War Two, but also in Vietnam, Korea, etc. All veterans. To put it into context, in World War One, Australia sent 415,000 men to fight in World War One for the British Empire. Now, at that time, Australia only had a population of about 5 million people, and only about 1 million of which were actually fighting age men. So over 40% of our fighting age men voluntarily decided to go and fight in World War One. There was no conscription, and we still had the highest participation rate of any allied country except Serbia, who started the war. All of Serbia was at war, basically. So a lot of Australians went to war. 65,000 men died in World War One from Australia. So, that's like 6.5% of our fighting age males died in World War One.
Wow.
And a further 100-something thousand were wounded. So most Australians knew someone at that time who died or was wounded, or had someone in their family or whatever who died or was wounded in the First World War. And we fought that not just because we were loyalists to the empire for some abstract reason. We fought that because we were obviously quite rationally afraid of the Japanese empire. The Japanese empire in the years preceding World War One had a war against the Russians, which they won. It was the first time a non-white power had defeated a white power in the modern world, in modern history. And so we were concerned about the rise of the Japanese empire a few years later, again, before World War One, that they annexed Korea. And they obviously had expansionist aims, as we saw after World War One, where in the 1930s they invade China, they start colonizing a large portion of China, and ultimately World War Two we have to fight the Japanese. For Australians, World War Two was more a story about fighting Japan with the Americans than it was about fighting in Europe against the Nazis.
True.
We did send some soldiers to go and fight in North Africa and Southern Europe earlier in the war. But as soon as Japan entered the war, we pulled every single one of our men out of Europe and brought them all back, because we did not care about fighting against National Socialism or fascism or whatever. We were simply there to defend the British Empire, but the British Empire began collapsing in its war in Europe, and it collapsed through the course of World War II. And the whole reason we were fighting to defend the British Empire was in order to have the British Empire defend us against the Japanese Empire. Well, when the British Empire collapsed, we had to fight the Japanese Empire directly with American help, not British help. And World War One was simply a calculation that, well, it was a little bit more than this. There were race patriots. They were proud Anglo-Saxons. But at the same time, there was a calculation that, well, if the Germans beat the British in World War One, who's going to be there to protect us against the Japanese? So, and then in the Treaty of Versailles, the Australian Prime Minister at the time, Billy Hughes, he argued very strongly when they were establishing the League of Nations to remove a clause that was highly considered and originally supposed to be in the League of Nations constitution or agreement or whatever it was, to ban racially restrictive immigration policies. We went to the League of Nations, or we went to the Treaty of Versailles and argued forcefully against that, said we committed hundreds of thousands of men, a higher percentage per capita of any country, and we're not going to compromise our White Australia policy. That's why we fought in this war. And yeah, we actually convinced the Americans to side with us. The American Congress was so isolationist, they didn't even join the League of Nations in the end, even though it was the Americans' idea. And that kind of killed it, which is the prototype of the UN. But that had to be argued for. But Billy Hughes, who was our prime minister, who argued that at the Treaty of Versailles, in 1915, in his address to the nation, when he was trying to convince men to sign up and fight for the British Empire, he said, "I bid thee to go and fight for a white Australia in France." That's what he said to the nation. Not Australia, a white Australia. And at that time, Australia was over 99% white. It was 99.8% of the soldiers we sent were white. There was about 800 to 1,000 Aboriginals, 415,000 white men, and a small, like maybe 80 or 90 Chinese guys. That was our, and now these days they try to say the Anzacs, they were a multicultural fighting force because there was a few Aboriginals or something. They were fighting for the White Australia policy and British imperial global domination. That's what they were fighting for. That's what they died for. They didn't die for multiculturalism or liberal democracy or any of this shit. And that's what we're actually celebrating on Anzac Day. We're celebrating for the men that bled for white Australia. So
they've done a hell of a job of, they've poured all this money into trying to redo these holidays, making them multicultural, multiracial, inclusive for everyone. But they typically leave out those founders. They leave out all that original stuff, right? When did this redoing of history, when did this start for Anzac Day? Do you know when in your lifetime? Do you remember any specific when they started this? Because this is thoroughly modern. This has not been around forever.
Yeah, so when I was growing up, the narrative was they fought for our freedom. It was more that kind of neocon angle. They fought for our freedom against fascism and communism and that type of thing, right? And then obviously we were at war in Iraq and Afghanistan in that time period. And it was framed in that, in like, you know, radical Islam is like the new fascism or the new communism. But that's no longer politically correct. And those wars are no longer happening. So that narrative is no longer relevant. What it has become in the 2010s onwards is that basically they were fighting for multiculturalism somehow, even though Australia was like the most racist country in the world back when the Anzacs were fighting. They were fighting for white nationalism. They were fighting for British imperial domination, like I said. So on Anzac Day in Melbourne, basically all over the country, you have dawn services, what they call dawn services. So about 5:30 in the morning, because the sun comes up around 6:20 that time of year. You get to there's local dawn services because there's a kind of veterans clubs all over the country where they can be held, and there's war memorials all over the country where they can be held. But there's big ones held in the major cities. And obviously Melbourne is the second biggest city in Australia, one of the two big cities in Australia, population of about 6 million people. And in the middle of Melbourne, there's something called the Shrine of Remembrance. So when the soldiers came back from World War One, they pulled their funds together and built a giant pagan temple to the ancestors in the middle of Melbourne. It's an incredible building. I say pagan temple it's not really a pagan temple. There is a lot of Christian symbolism in it, but it looks like something out of ancient Greece or something. It's quite an impressive building. Incredible iconography. It's quite breathtaking. And it was built, but as a temple to the ancestors. It's literally a temple. It's not just a shrine. And they, on Remembrance Day, on Anzac Day, and other times of the year, services are held there to commemorate those who died in the various wars and so on. And so obviously on Anzac Day, that's the big day. So there's like 50,000 people there. And they do the dawn service. So the dawn service is all about, you know, reading, reciting poetry and prayers and recounting, you know, great stories of heroism and sacrifice. And it's all official. All the top, you know, members of government and the military and everyone is all there. And it's a very formal thing and somber thing. What you're showing there, that's not the shrine. That's in... that's in Brisbane, actually. That's the war memorial in Brisbane, which also is quite beautiful. Yeah, it's like a cenotaph. I've been there before. There's little swastikas in it.
I had never seen that one before, but this is what they're showing. Let me because the Anzac one I had up, it has a pyramid on top. It's very cool too. Hold on here.
Yeah, so we got pretty cool war memorials around the country. That one there is in Brisbane. That's a different
why is it coming up? Anzac, this is the one I want it right here. This
yeah, that's the one in Melbourne.
That's the one I want it. I know these. And let's see if it'll take me to the page. This is the Australian government page. It's taking a minute to pull up. Here, hold on here. Okay, why isn't it giving me a big picture? I guess it's not giving me a big picture. Shrine of Remembrance. See if I can pull it up. A better picture. There's one. That's striking.
Yeah, so this was built in, I think it was launched in the early 1930s. When it was opened, the population of Melbourne was only about 1 million people, and over 300,000 people showed up to the opening for, you know, the first Remembrance Day celebration or what have you. And it's quite an incredible structure.
Inside looks incredible too.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite special. If you ever come to Melbourne, if you're a foreigner, obviously you'd be a nationalist and a racialist if you're watching the program, go and check this building out. It's quite something. But so before the dawn service commemorates, they decide to do a so-called welcome to country where they pay 10 grand to one of these professional Aboriginal activists, a so-called Aboriginal elder, which we have to refer to as uncle or auntie in an official capacity. And so Uncle Mark Brown, who is, I don't know, a quarter Aboriginal or an eighth Aboriginal or something, he stands up there.
This dude speaking right there? The dude with the earrings
with
and
a
stuff?
baseball. He stands out there with a baseball hat on. Doesn't mention one thing about war or soldiers or the Anzacs or anything like that. The Anzacs were the men who fought in World War One, by the way. It's the Australian New Zealand Army Corps. Australia and New Zealand's forces were combined in World War One to fight for the British Empire. So that's where the phrase Anzac Day comes from. But we still commemorate soldiers who fought in later wars, even though they're not technically Anzacs at the same time. Anyone who fought for Australia. But we also think about people who fought for New Zealand. Australia and New Zealand have a very close relationship.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's standing up there and he gives everyone a lecture for 5 minutes about how this is the land of his fathers and his ancestors and they never ceded sovereignty to us. And you are visitors. We are all visitors on the land of his ancestors. And anyway, we knew they were going to do something like this, and we planned for a while. If they do something like this, we're going to be there, and we're going to boo. Jacob Hursten did very well to get right up near the front.
Yeah.
And he let it rip so loud that you could hear him screaming through the microphones. It was projected to 50,000 people, and it was also live broadcast on television. And you can hear Jacob yelling, "This is Australia! What about the Anzacs? Boo!" And then other people are booing. Some of the other boys are there. Booing, yelling things out.
I can try to play it here. They might have picked it up. I think this particular clip, these clips were fantastic because Jacob Hursten was actually carried by Russia Today as an Australian nationalist. You know, they just, which is legit. It's a legit way to carry it. But there's like, you know, the noticer did such a good job that other news broadcasters are carrying the clips.
Very similar message.
Yeah, I think.
We also pay our acknowledgement and respects to all traditional custodians of Australia.
It's Australia!
We acknowledge
their
continuous and unbroken connection to country for all of their people. And we thank each and every single one of them for being here with us.
Yeah, it was a bit startling. It's not...
It was startling.
Yeah, so this has basically been national news in Australia for 5 days straight. It's been massive. Every single politician and political thought leader or journalist or whatever, everyone's weighed in on it. It was all over the front page of the news for a couple of days. They keep talking about it on all the political shows, left wing, right wing, whatever. Because basically what happened was Jacob and some of the boys booed it. The media covered it like it was the most horrible thing that's ever happened ever. It was like another Holocaust or something. But then basically the majority of people were like, it was good that he booed it, actually. Or people said, maybe he shouldn't have booed it, but why is there a welcome to country that's offensive? Why are we welcoming people who fought for our country as if they're visitors to their own country? While we're commemorating men who died for our country, why are we telling them that it's not their country at the same time? It's ridiculously disrespectful. And so it really struck at the core of like the identity of Australia. Is Australia what the white man built and bled for? Or is Australia, you know, basically an Aboriginal land and we're all just evil colonial visitors?
How many Abos are there right now? Because they're a tiny minority, correct?
Yeah, so like in the official statistics, they're now about 3% of the population. But the thing is,
it's like the Indians here.
Most of them aren't actually Aboriginals because there's a massive incentive to legally identify as an Aboriginal because you get incredible government benefits.
I got you.
So the Aboriginal population has rapidly spiked far faster than their birth rate would suggest in recent years because of all of the benefits like affirmative action, welfare, etc. Also, a lot of people who identify as Aboriginal are like 1/8 Aboriginal or 1/16 Aboriginal. And some of them, though, you'll look at them and they're like blonde hair, blue eyes. I'm an Aboriginal. I'm black, you know. And then you can't question it, apparently, or because it's insensitive or some shit. So the amount of pure-blooded Aboriginals is very small. And the pure-blooded Aboriginals, if you're a white person and you live where most other white people live, you never see them your entire life. Like, I've barely met any in my entire life. I've been in this country my whole life. So you know, I have met many half-caste and so on, and I've seen them before, but they're basically marginalized because a full-blooded Aboriginal is literally too retarded to exist in mainstream society. So they usually live out in remote communities, or they live in the real poorest areas of the major cities where they're kind of sectioned off. And they're basically like, in the same sense that like the state has to like take care of people who are mentally disabled, they have to take care of Aboriginals.
Right. Keep them from drinking, huffing gas and doing all kinds of stuff like this. And they're usually committing crime from time to time.
Yeah, their crime rate is much higher than the Africans. So, like, the African immigrants they bring in from, like, Somalia.
That's quite a statement. That's a statement.
Make them make law-abiding citizens by comparison to the Aboriginals.
Wow.
Probably because they've got about 15, IQ, 10 IQ points on them. And, you know, these Sudanese, these Somalis, they're not sending their best. They aren't the sharpest tools in the shed, let's say, from these parts of the world. And these people are horrible criminals. I mean, there's a massive black crime wave happening in Melbourne right now. People are getting their houses broken into with a bunch of like blacks with machetes running through their house on a regular basis. Now this has become the new normal, but Aboriginals are still far worse. But thankfully there isn't that many Aboriginals around in Sydney or Melbourne because they live out in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, sucks to suck if you live out in those remote communities because the amount of petty crime is ridiculous and serious crime is ridiculous. But yeah, their rape rates, their murder rates, et cetera, just completely dwarf the black population or any other immigrant demographic. The rates of child rape within their own communities are like insane. Like we're talking about, there's some Aboriginal communities where like all the kids at the like between the ages of like 6 and 9 at like the local school, where like 80% of them have STDs.
How does that even work?
From the parents. They have the same ones as the parents usually. Yeah.
IQ of the Aboriginals? What is it? Do you even know?
The average of a pure blood Aboriginal is like 65.
That's not even.
62 by some estimates.
It's incomprehensible because you're dealing with some, like our Africans in America have a percentage. We don't know. I don't know what it is. Percentage white, but I think the studies are a little bit dubious. But they tend to be to most people on the planet smarter than the average like sub-Saharan African these days. So you're talking about something that has serious numbers underneath that. I'm surprised they can even function.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of them, there's not that many that are full-blooded that you deal with in the cities. So a lot of these Aboriginal activists, like I said, they're an eighth Aboriginal, they're a quarter Aboriginal, maybe half Aboriginal at best.
Yeah, this guy's not 100% right here. Anzac Day football, welcome to country. He's like along the lines of one of these guys here giving this speech, this guy right here. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's like not even half these guys. Probably.
Yeah, this is what a full-blooded one looks like. They look pretty much like Africans here, blacks.
No, that's not what a normal one looks like, okay, to be honest.
All right. Hold on.
Let's go here. That guy looks more African. But yeah, like they look – it's hard to describe what they look like. They look kind of like if you just kind of got a bunch of like Indians,
Bangladeshi, like, Dravidians. They look like Dravidians.
Yeah, and you inbred them. Basically, if you then put them on an island and made them like have sex with their sisters for like 60,000 years,
oh god,
you'd produce this.
And
yeah, that's more what they look like.
All right, Anzac Day, and people aren't having it anymore.
Yeah, well, it's a very recent thing to do welcome to countries on Anzac Day. And then they then tried to gaslight everyone like, well, we've always done this. And this is just part of Anzac Day. And these people are disrespecting the veterans. And it's like, no, we were defending the veterans, actually. It's the opposite. You guys are disrespecting the veterans with this bullshit. And the people agree. So they told the whole of Australia, oh, the boos were done by neo-Nazis. Okay, that's actually true. Like it was done by us. And the people were like, we don't care. We agree with them anyway. And now all the conservative politicians came out agreeing that the welcome to country needs to be gotten rid of. And there's an election this weekend. And the main conservative politician in the center-right Liberal Party who came out. He was the first politician to come out and condemn us and started yapping about the Holocaust for fucking 10 minutes. Then he's had to kind of revise his position because he's realized that basically there's an election coming up and he wants to be on the right side on this issue. And so he flipped and now he's attacking the Welcome to Country as well. So it could have the unfortunate side effect of enabling the conservatives to come back from, because the conservatives, liberal party, they looked like that they were going to win the election a few months ago and they burned through all of their positive public sentiment by basically siding with the Jews over the Christmas period and their attacks on freedom of speech in Australia, which is a whole issue. I don't know if we've discussed this before. And then they burned through a lot of their support there. And then basically they decided to run a campaign with no actual policies that were of significance while we're in the middle of a historic immigration-induced housing crisis. The levels of immigration have been insane the last few years. Immigration has never been this unpopular in all the opinion polling, and they're refusing to really run against it or basically run on anything that's controversial or particularly right-wing. And so they've been bleeding votes to the minor right-wing parties. So the smaller right-wing parties to the right of the Liberal Party look like they're going to have their best result ever in Australian political history, where they're probably going to get between 15% and 20% of the vote, which is a big deal because there's a bit of a breakdown in the duopoly that's starting to occur, which is a great thing. But so he's trying to get some of those votes back basically by siding with us. So we're controlling the narrative. We're setting the narrative basically in Australian politics. And they're telling everyone they're neo-Nazis. And the response by Australian common sense patriots online has been to either say, who cares? We agree with them. Or, so what? Like, you're a Nazi if you're against Welcome to Country. This is the media is just gaslighting us. So no one's buying it. If you look at the comment sections, they tried to spin this as so many ways and they couldn't spin it. And left-wingers, immigrants who hate white people and so on are seething and melting down online. But you can see that we won the debate on this very clearly and decisively. There's been a whole national conversation over the past week. And it was started by Jacob Hassan and the National Socialist Network, and it was a decisive victory. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, Pauline Hanson she's a name I know of. She kind of plays both sides on this one, according to her Twitter. I want to say something very clearly because Australians deserve honesty and respect. On Anzac Day, services across the country, some booed Welcome to the Country. I don't support that. Anzac Day should never be disrupted. It's sacred day to honor men and women who gave everything for our country. But that's not what Welcome to Country does, though. But I do understand why people are fed up. So she kind of has both sides. But the Welcome to Country business is what people are reacting to. I like it.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, like, conservative leaders will say, oh, well, they shouldn't have booed, but also the Welcome to Country I don't support. And then you look at the comment section, and then the comment section is all their followers saying, yeah, but they should have booed it, or I would boo it too, and things like that. So, the sentiment of the people is they're righteously indignant against being disrespected far more than they care about us being Nazis or the irreverence of the booing or whatever. So, it was a pretty successful piece of activism, let's say, but it wasn't, we don't even want to do activism on Australia Day. On Anzac Day. That's the one day we usually don't do anything. And we weren't in uniform. We didn't march. We didn't have banners or anything like that. We don't believe in doing that on Anzac Day. We believe in just being members of the public, venerating our ancestors. But if they're going to do this, like, something had to be done. And next year it will either be canceled, or we will organize a massive campaign across Australia for everyone to boo it next time, and it will get booed by the whole crowd, and it'll be, and then it will never happen again.
Looking at this comment. As a veteran, I believe they had every bloody right to boo at Welcome to the Country. Anzac Day is to remember the sacrifices of our past and present military personnel. If I had been at one of these places, I would have booed too.
Yeah. That's the sentiment of of the majority of the comment section.
Well, 7 out of 10 want Welcome to Country ceremony stopped completely. It's a big number.
Yeah, and actually there was a football game in Melbourne, rugby league game, which Americans might not know what that is. It's a form of rugby. But they canceled the Welcome to Country that night. And then they said, oh, you know, we just wanted to protect, you know, the Aboriginal lady from getting booed by the crowd. But I think actually they were waiting for an excuse to do it because they got more like conservative millionaires on the board of directors of that football team. So I think they were happy to use the excuse. And so you're starting to see conservatives get emboldened to start canceling this kind of stuff when they previously didn't have the balls to do it, basically. Hopefully the cascade reaction continues, but now it's become an animating like issue in the election campaign. And it's the, like I said, it's a national conversation in Australia, and it's a good conversation to have because it really, as I said before, it strikes at the root of our national identity.
What is going on in the election? Give us an overview.
Yeah. So we have a Labor government. Labor is the centre-left party, and they're pretty wildly unpopular because they've attacked free speech, they've brought in insane amounts of immigration, the economy is a disaster zone, mostly due to immigration, because in Australia, from over the last 3 years since they got in to now, they've brought in like almost 2 million people, and you know, in the major cities, rents, average rents have gone up by like 60, 70, 80%. And people can't afford to, house prices keep spiking. Like the median house price in Sydney now is $1.7 million. Now in American dollars, that's like 1.1 million or something like that, 1.2 million. But that's for an average shitty house in not even a white neighborhood. You're paying over $1 million U.S.,
who can afford
for a shitty
that?
House. Yeah, so it's getting ridiculous where young people can't afford to buy homes. Then you have to go rent. Rents are jacked up because you're competing with all these Indians on student visas and shit to try and find a rental. There's about 3 million people in Australia on temporary visas. It's a population of 27 million people. So
wow,
more than 10% of the population is on temporary visas.
What is rent in Sydney? Give us an example. Something.
Yeah,
like,
I think
like
the median rent in Sydney is like $650 a week.
Yikes.
Yeah. So what's that a month? Like fucking almost $3,000 a month.
Yeah, it sounds like Toronto. All these, they increase these populations. It makes the place unlivable because rent's so high. And other reasons as well.
Well, in Canada, they had their Liberal Party. There is the left wing party, so it's like the opposite side to our Liberal Party, which are the so called Conservative Party. I've been trying to spread this idea that we need to, for too long in Australian politics, the line between left and right has apparently been drawn between the Liberal and Labor Party. I say it should be drawn on the other side of the Liberal Party, between the Liberal Party and the actual right-wing parties, because the Liberal Party is a party of the left. Liberal Party was responsible in the late 70s for instituting multiculturalism as an official policy of our government, in the 90s for taking away our guns, in the 2000s for radically expanding immigration, in the 2010s for legalizing gay marriage. This is not a conservative party, if these are the things that they're implementing. And we should consider them to be a party of the left, just like the so-called opposition. And a lot of more people are kind of coming around to that view than ever before, which is encouraging, but it's not going to be enough this election for it to translate to forming like a populist right government or anything. But it's enough probably to cost the Liberals the election, which they would have won because of the momentum that they had. But In Canada, their left-wing party, about a year ago, they were tanking in the polls, and so they slashed immigration, and rents have now come down, house prices have stabilized, and they look like they're going to win. They got rid of Trudeau as well, who everyone hated, but now it looks like they're going to win in Canada, who are also about to have an election. But our left-wing, they didn't do that. They doubled down, and the conservatives pretend to complain about it, but basically say, oh, well, immigration is up 70% on what it was, you know, before. So we're going to cut it by 25%. Vote for us. And it's like, why only 25%? Well, I'll tell you why. Why not at least lie at like what Trump did and pretend like you're going to cut it much more and then just lie and win? The reason why is because the property developer lobby or the property developer industry is the number one campaign contributor of any industry in Australian politics. And they give more money to the Liberal, so-called Conservative Party, than any other party. And they're the number one benefactors of mass immigration. The number one individual donor to the Liberal Party is Meriton Properties, which is owned by Harry Triguboff, Australia's richest property developer and Australia's richest Jew, who is a massive supporter of mass immigration. There's never enough immigration. You could bring in, you know, it doesn't matter how many you bring in, he wants more because he wants to build more high-rise Jeep boxes to shove people in and sell them $1 million a pop. So that's who's paying for their campaign. So they can't even pretend to be against mass immigration too much because then they'll lose all their donors and they care more about getting that sweet donor money than they care about even winning. They care more about donors than votes. So that's the situation. But in the lead up to this election, it was interesting. They've completely shut up about it. Over Christmas and the early part of the year, you had a whole series of false flag attacks, which our intelligence agencies came out and said, and the federal police came out and said, basically organized crime was getting paid by foreign state actors to stage anti-Semitic false flags and firebomb synagogues and create fake terrorist attacks against Jews. And then they just completely just memory hold all those stories. But while those stories were being published in the media, they used them as a pretext to pass laws at the federal and state level to take away freedom of speech and to make massive attacks on our freedom of speech, saying, oh, anti-Semitism and racism is getting out of control. There's all these terrorist attacks against Jews. The Jewish community isn't safe. We have to take away all the goys' free speech. And then they pass all these laws, and it comes out that these were false flag attacks staged by organized crime. Not that even if they were real terrorist attacks that it would justify taking away free speech, but the pretext was false. Obviously, it's the Mossad. Obviously, it's Israel. What other foreign state actor would do this? And then everyone's just told to shut up and forget about it. And then we go into the election cycle, and the Liberal Party, which couldn't stop going on every day about how much it worships Israel and worships the Jews and attacking the Labor government for being, they're not even pro-Palestine, but not for supporting a two-state solution instead of supporting like total Gaza genocide or something. Apparently they're anti-Semites and they're emboldening these fake terrorist attacks or something. Instead of going on about how we got to give Jews more free money, which is an official policy on their website, by the way, to literally give the Jewish community no strings attached free money, or attacking our freedom of speech or voting with Israel at the UN or whatever, they then focus grouped it and realized no one gives a shit about Israel or the Jews and no one likes any of this stuff. And so they just shut up about it, but they already lost a lot of their goodwill through the process. So, you know, Australian politics, it's a shit show, but it's kind of like every week the Nazis keep popping up and like setting new agendas, and we've been very metapolitically successful. I can't think of another country in the world where Nazis have so much influence over the political conversation. So,
yeah, you guys are being rascals, that's for sure. What all is going on with your particular groups over there? Is there any trials coming up? And what exactly? I know this is the one in the news, Stephen Wells, who I'm sure you know.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with him so much, but he hasn't been granted bail. Can you give us an overview on what's going on?
Yeah, so I think at the moment there's something like 60 active cases against people in our organization.
It's pretty difficult.
Like criminal cases.
Right.
All due to activism. Like not because people are engaging in violence or doing anything. Like all just purely from political activism. The majority of those cases pertain to events in Adelaide around Australia Day and before. So Australia Day is in late January, so about 3 months ago. And Australia Day, like I mentioned earlier, is like our Independence Day. So Anzac Day and Australia Day, there are two main national holidays. And on Australia Day, we were in Adelaide because we always do a national meet for our organization every Australia Day. We pick a particular city in the country. We take some of the boys there from the other states. We do a fight competition. We do a 10K run. We do speeches. We do seminar, and we do a street march usually to celebrate Australia Day. And on Australia Day, all the official Australia Day celebrations that were shut down during the COVID pandemic and they were never brought back because apparently they're racist or something, and instead permits are given to communists and Aboriginals to host a giant Invasion Day rally, what they call it, down the middle of every major city, where they hold up signs saying death to Australia, death to the colony, you know, kill Whitey, and march about how Australia's illegitimate and it's Aboriginal land and all this bullshit. So that's happening in every city, but there isn't an official Australia Day march. So we said, well, we're going to celebrate Australia in the streets then. Someone has to. So we went to organize our Australia Day march. And 2 weeks before we got to Adelaide, the Adelaide chapter of our organization, they did just a kind of banner action where they had a big mass deportations now banner. We've used that before in other capacities. And they just kind of held it up on a bridge over a highway or something to get some photos and get a little bit of attention. And they were all wearing the balaclavas. And they found some obscure law in South Australia that says wearing an article of disguise or possessing an article of disguise is a crime. And they raided a bunch of their houses. They arrested them. They dragged them before a magistrate and they forced them to sign bail conditions saying they weren't able to associate with other members of the organization, specifically because they were afraid that on Australia Day, we would do a march. They knew we were coming to Adelaide this year. They got intelligence. So that law, it doesn't actually apply because it says whilst in the commission of a crime, they weren't committing a crime. They were standing there holding a banner. So these charges will get dropped in court or they'll win in court and they won't matter. But there was the process is the punishment. The intent was if we put a charge on them, we can get a magistrate to apply bail conditions so that they can't get released from remand prison without signing away their freedom to politically associate. And then by the time they get it all straightened out, it'll be months later. So they did that to about 15 of our members. So then we rock up to Adelaide. All the Adelaide leadership aren't allowed to talk to us, and we have to figure out how to organize the weekend, but still managed to make it work. There was one guy who managed to, he had a good lawyer and wrangled out of the bail conditions. He got lucky with a sympathetic magistrate, and so he was able to kind of run the show. So we managed to still show up and do our thing. We had our fight comp. And then we get to Australia Day and we assembled at the War Memorial actually in Adelaide and we were going to march. We weren't going to go march over and counter protest the Aboriginal rally because we don't believe in protesting. Like they're the ones protesting. We believed in celebrating on Australia Day. Like they're protesting us. We're not protesting against them. So we had our Aussie flags. Because they were being funny about the masks, we all went mask off. So some of the boys didn't come because they didn't want to get doxxed. But we had 70 boys willing to walk in the street as open national socialists, no mask. We had Australian flags. We were singing Waltzing Matilda, which is an Australian folk song everyone in Australia knows. And we were doing our thing. But basically, as we're trying to get to the War Memorial, the police were saying on television for days, the Nazis are going to rally in the city. We're going to have a special police task force to try and stop them. And they were trying to intimidate us out of doing it. And so we knew they were probably going to do arrests and they were going to try and get us. But we tried to figure out a tactic to get in anyway and do the rally anyway and risk getting arrested. We didn't mind. We said, let them arrest us with our Australian flags on Australia Day and see how that looks to the public. And, so that's what happened. They grabbed a bunch of guys on the way in, but most of us got in. When I was actually walking to the War Memorial, a cop actually grabbed my shoulder and I had to wrestle kind of my shoulder off him and run across the street. He tried to arrest me for quote unquote loitering. Whatever that means. How can you be loitering if you're walking down a street and moving? But the police, they made about 15 or 16 arrests on the day, including Tom. Tom started giving a speech and they just came and grabbed him and arrested him. And it was broadcast on national television. Anyway, we still managed to, after Tom got arrested, I said, let's march because we got to keep moving so that the rest of us don't get arrested, basically. And we marched around for about half an hour. And then when we got to like the conclusion, they then tried to do another kind of mass arrest. So we just split and ran in different directions. But they grabbed that gentleman, Stephen Wells, who's an older gentleman, and arrested him at that point. And so there was, as I said, I think 15 arrests on the day of our guys, something like that. And it was all bullshit charges. They said one of the charges were wearing articles of disguise. Obviously, they had pre-planned that, but that we didn't wear masks. So they were defining hats and sunglasses as articles of disguise that are apparently illegal. Apparently, it's illegal to wear a hat and sunglasses in Adelaide, which is just insane. That was a law that was put in back in like the 50s or the 60s so that if someone like robbed a bank or something, they could charge them with possessing like an article of disguise, like when they were leaving the scene or something, they had like a balaclava in their pocket or a balaclava on, as like a lesser charge that they could make stick, in cases like that. And, anyway, so they were also arresting people with so-called refusal to cease loitering. Loitering is defined as basically being somewhere without a reason. We were there for a reason. We were there to celebrate Australia Day, so it made no sense. These are really minor nothing burger charges. Most of them have been dropped at this point. But these people were denied bail and held in prison for 2 days because of these silly charges. Then when I went down to pick them up from the jailhouse 2 days later, when they were being released, I was confronted by the media and a bunch of police. I was giving a media interview, and then the police came over and informed me that, in fact, I was loitering. I got into an argument with them about, no, I'm not loitering. I'm here to pick up my friends, and now I'm answering questions from the media.
I played that back when
and
it
then,
happened.
Yeah, and then they then said that, oh, that's Joel. He was wearing a Nazi symbol, which is apparently illegal, on Sunday, on Australia Day. Arrest him. So then I was arrested. They then said that the belt buckle I was wearing, because it had an eagle on it, is also a Nazi symbol. So I got charged with two counts of displaying a Nazi symbol, which carry up to a 1 year jail term under these new laws that they've passed. That we're like the first people charged under them. And they defined the national, because in the uniform on the arm, we have a patch with the symbol of the National Socialist Network. It's a unique symbol that was invented by Jacob Hursten. It's basically a cross, but it's a cross made out of converging arrows. They say that it's a Nazi symbol because it vaguely resembles the arrow cross of the Hungarian fascists, but the Hungarian fascists are not national socialists. So like, it doesn't even make sense. Like, fascist symbols aren't banned. Nazi symbols are banned. Also,
they're just making shit up because it's
they're
you
making
guys
shit up.
It.
Yeah. They didn't even charge anyone with that on the day. They came up with this. They invented this 2 days later, and they started slapping these charges on some people. Some of the people they arrested hadn't actually got in uniform yet. They arrested a lot of them on the way in, so they couldn't put the charge on them, but they put the charge on myself, on Thomas Sewell, and a few other, about, I think maybe four or five of the other boys that they arrested in uniform, including Stephen Wells. So a lot of the other charges are getting dropped, but that's still happening. We believe the law is unconstitutional. We have a right to political communication in this country, and there's a high court precedent, and the high court is the equivalent of the Supreme Court of the United States. It's like the constitutional court. The high court found in the 1990s that symbols and offensive speech and so on are all protected under our right to political communication. So we believe we can win in the high court, but it's a long process. So we've been raising money. If you want to donate, by the way, givesendgo.com/whiteaustralia, a little shilling. I hope you don't mind, but we're trying to get a lot of cash together so that we can pay for high quality lawyers and have our day in court, which we will hopefully eventually have.
So white Australia?
Trying to legality of law. Huh?
White Australia?
Yep. givesendgo.com/whiteaustralia.
There it is. Let me put up a link for these guys.
Yeah.
All right. It looks like, which I'm always happy to see these various different right-wing groups, nationalist groups, when they're trying to raise money, they're able to raise money, which is fantastic that you guys have been able to raise $55,000. But you've got so many court cases ongoing. And Stephen Wells is the only one in jail. Is that my understanding?
Yes, still? Stephen Wells refused. So the rest of us have signed bail conditions that bar us from associating with other members of the organization. So I can't legally associate with Jacob Hassan or Thomas Sewell at the moment.
Until the court case is over. Until you've had your day.
Yeah, well, Tom and I have the same lawyer, and our lawyer went to court recently and did a bail amendment to try and challenge the legality of our bail conditions, because they're actually it's not lawful for them to give us these bail conditions under South Australian law. The magistrate then defined himself as a victim. He said that we, the community, are all victims of what we've done, even though we haven't even been found guilty yet. And we're being charged with having a cross patch on our arm that no one even knows what it means. This is apparently victimizing him and the entire community. And so, therefore, legal arguments don't matter. But in Australia, at the magistrate level, which is the lowest level, the courts are they're kangaroo courts. They're ridiculous. So we're considering we could appeal the bail amendment to get rid of the non-association clause to the Supreme Court of South Australia. That would probably cost 15 to 20 grand. Or we can just kind of speed run it, get found guilty, and then appeal the decision, and then we can get rid of the bail conditions that way. So we can put that money towards the high court challenge, which is going to be a lot more expensive.
How long does it take to get a high court challenge? What is a timeline for something like
well,
that?
Well, that's indeterminate, because there's different pathways. So there's one way of just incrementally going up stage by stage through the courts. It takes longer. Or there's ways you can jump straight to the high court, but that comes with certain pros and cons. So we're evaluating at the moment with legal advisors and lawyers that want to represent us what strategy we think is the maximum chances of success, because we think we have a real chance of success in the higher courts. Are not perfect, but they're better. If you make they're more reasonable, you can make arguments, and like they've made decisions that aren't so bad in the past. Not perfect, but we think we have a crack. So we don't want to take the wrong strategy and fuck this up, because if we win this case, it would be a serious political victory, because it would create a cascade reaction where a lot of these laws that have been passed under the pressure of the Jewish lobby to ban swastikas and salutes and all the rest of it, but more importantly, anti-vilification laws, hate speech laws, and so on, if we get a decision in our favor, it could have a knock-on effect of either annulling or greatly reducing the scope of a lot of these laws, and we would basically secure a degree of free speech in Australia. And we'd be able to walk out of the court and declare a political victory for our cause. It'd be probably the first Nazi political victory since 1945. So,
are you going to go out of the court and throw Romans? Is that the goal?
Well, if we get them legalized, abso-fucking-lutely, of course we will.
That's pretty funny.
And that'll be
legalized free
moment.
Speech, finally. They're being forced to rule on forcing them to rule on free speech in regards to some type of outlier, meaning things that wouldn't normally apply on any given day, but apply to, this type of political free speech regarding definitely a political outlier, something on the right wing that that they want to ban and they can't really deal with. Other than throw people in jail. I just don't know how the higher courts in Australia are going to treat that. History is any precedent, they should just throw it all out and say it's free speech. But it's a very political thing. I don't know if the system can handle that.
But we want to at least force a decision, because it will be a very high-profile case. And we need a decision. Do we have a liberal democracy? Do we have a representative democracy? Do we have the right to openly express our political views in Australia or not? Supposedly we did until now. All of a sudden the Jews have decided it's offensive, the guys have too much free speech. The guys have a liberal democratic system where they get to say things that make us upset and hurt our feelings. And the communists and the Jews agree that that's wrong and that it should be gotten rid of. But we still have a constitution. We still have high court precedent. So they, on paper, can't do this. And no one's challenged it properly and directly yet. So we're going to challenge it. We are basically the canary in the coal mine. And if we lose, we can then go to the Australian people and say, okay, we're going to need a political movement here to push for a referendum, to push for a referendum to defend our freedom of speech. We need an American-style First Amendment. And Australians like free speech. And if you look at the opinion polling, younger Australians are more supportive of free speech than older Australians. So, but free speech is the majority position. We're an Anglo-Saxon country, so shock horror, people like having freedom to speak and think what they want. And so, again, like the welcome to country thing, we're on the side of the majority on this issue. So they keep giving us issues where the Nazis can be the voice of reason and the voice of the people, the forgotten men and women, the common sense patriots out there. We get to be the spearhead of the masses. Over and over again, the Aussie battlers, the white working class people. And it's all they're doing is handing us political legitimacy on a platter, and at the same time undermining their own through short-sightedness and hysteria. So, and obviously at the moment as well, we're in the process of getting together to form a political party.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that? Where can I find out anything about this on the internet? Is there something up on the internet that I can pull up?
Well, we haven't launched the party yet, but okay. You can go to whiteaustralia.org if you're in Australia, if you're an Australian citizen. You have to be an Australian citizen, and you can sign up as a supporter or a member if you want to join the organization directly.
Okay.
But we have not launched the party yet. We will launch the party, maybe later this year.
I like the name, the plain name. It harkens back to the past, White Australia, as in the White Australia policy. It's very upfront.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what it's all about. That's our number one principle, White Australia. That's what we're all about. That's what
organic,
it comes down to.
Organic. So what is the process to form a political party? Can you guys – wasn't there another White Australia party at one time?
There was never a party that went by that name.
Okay.
But the White Australia policy was support – the parties that currently exist, the Labor Party, they're in power right now. Well, they were the champions of the White Australia policy, the champions of it for the first half of our Federated Nations existence. But it was a bipartisan thing. Everyone supported the White Australia policy until the 60s. It started to kind of fall apart. And the 70s was when it was actually taken apart. 70s and 80s, ultimately. The final aspects of it were fully repealed. But, in Australia, we have the right to form political parties. So, again, thanks to our constitution. In the 1950s, the conservative government at the time, at the height of the Cold War, they tried to ban the Communist Party, and they were barred from doing so by the Constitution, by the High Court. So they held a referendum to try and change the Constitution to give them the authority to ban political parties. It failed. The Australian people unanimously rejected the notion that we should empower government to ban political parties for ideological reasons, even though no one supported communism. And so it failed. Multiple national socialist parties had formed in the 60s and the 70s that contested elections as like open national socialists with the swastika and everything. They didn't do too well because the White Australia policy hadn't even been fully destroyed yet at that time. So it was a bit early. People weren't really ready for the message yet. But nevertheless, there's precedent. There's precedent that national socialists have openly participated in the Australian political system. No political party has ever been banned in Australian history. The requirements are very simple. If you want to contest a national election, you basically need 1,500 members. If you can get 1,500 people that are registered voters, that are full citizens, to sign on and say, yes, I'm a member of this party, they can't do anything to stop you. They have to let you form a party. So,
it's a parliamentary system, right? It's how it works.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so, usually in the United Kingdom, they play a hell of a lot of games. I wonder if they're going to be able to do that there, or if maybe it's not something they really thought about.
They're not more space to do so. Now, who knows? Because of us, they could try. They could try. But it would be, again, we'd be going to the High Court with very strong arguments, and we'd be going to the Australian people with very strong arguments and saying, why are we not allowed to participate in the system? Aren't you guys, isn't the problem that you guys have that you're worried about so-called extremism and terrorism and all this kind of stuff? That's what the narrative was. Well, now we're trying to do things, we're trying to participate in the system. We're trying to, if you don't like us, don't vote for us. We're trying to do things according to the rules. And you still got a problem with that? You know, at a certain level, it's like you got to, like, at some point, you got to meet us somewhere and let us and let us play ball.
How much is it super expensive to form a new political party in Australia?
No, it's not super expensive. There are, like, you have to pay to field candidates and okay. to register. There's registration fees, but
do you have a mandatory number of candidates you have to run, or is it just you can form a political party and just run candidates in one particular?
Yeah, I think you only need a minimum of one candidate, I believe, but I mean, okay. I can look at the Electoral Act, but we want to field more than one.
Yeah, anyways, yeah, I was just curious on any details, because sometimes there's a variety of different games, but if you only need one party to, because do you have independent candidates that form their own party and run, whether it be ABOs or Shitlibs or anything like that there?
There's heaps of parties in Australia. There's like scores and scores of parties registered.
Yeah, I think you froze here. Oh, there you go. You unfroze. All right, cool. Okay.
Yeah, like when I looked at the Senate voting sheet, there's like 19 parties registered in the state of Victoria fielding Senate candidates in the upcoming election. So there's plenty of parties. And, you know, we think that there's a voter base for White Australia. For a white Australian party for white Australians.
I think as long as the party is simple, white first, and trying to restore what your ancestors built, something simple like that that they can grab onto. Because if we look at the reaction to ANZAC or the welcome to country ceremonies, you clearly have a majority of white Australians that get it. Things have gone too far. And I think you can take advantage of that if by keeping things simple, like white Australia, and just, you know, white Australia is an ideal. You know, it's the rebirth.
Also,
we have
a few advantages. One is that we can't fart sideways without the media reporting on it in this country.
That's true.
They're turning us into folk heroes. Like, and we've got personalities. Like, we've got people like Tom. Blair Cottrell. We've got people like Jacob Hursant. Yeah. Like myself, like Thomas Sewell, like others, people that are far more intelligent and interesting than any of the politicians in the system.
That's a problem.
And we have a lot of notoriety. We have the ability to constantly go viral online in ways that no politician can. And our policies are going to be way more interesting. Like, our policies are going to be things like execute pedophiles and nationalize the banking system and forgive everyone's mortgage. In addition to the obvious, deportation and stop immigration and so on. We're gonna go to the women of Australia and say, vote for us. We want to pay you to be stay-at-home moms so you can stay home and make white babies.
I'm kind of interested because now you're getting coffee. Now you're going beyond like stop immigration, taking a few pet issues. Now you're going full on across the board. I'm curious to see how all this ends up. Some of it can be overwhelming.
These policies are fucking popular.
Oh yeah.
But no one is getting close to them. And I think when people hear what policies we have, they're gonna be, holy shit, like the Nazis have insanely good policies. What the hell? And it's like, yeah, so did the original ones, you know.
How many people call you? This word has been used so much, though. I mean, even Pauline Hanson saying we don't really know what you mean by Nazi and stuff like that. I mean, this word is used so much. And you have so many young guys on camera, tongue-in-cheek, or being serious, saying, yeah, whatever, I'm a neo-Nazi. Yeah, whatever you say I am, this is what we're for. This has been used so much that the average white guy in Australia is, like, willing to listen to someone and say, yeah, I don't really give a shit what you call him. How much of that is in there, other than people like?
People have said for a long time, look, maybe we could identify as a nationalist or a white nationalist, but don't identify as a national socialist. Don't be a Nazi. Don't be a neo-Nazi. Don't be a racist.
Well, the term has been used so much, I don't even know if people know what it means.
No, let's be the ultimate version of what we are, and then let's desensitize the public to it. And obviously, that's the biggest lift.
I think they are desensitized. This word has been used so much.
We have been putting in the metapolitical work for years now to desensitize them to it, to the point where in Australia that the label neo-Nazi is losing potency.
And to be fair, if we go over to your uniforms, I mean, you have all Australian nationalist type symbols. You are wearing black, but big deal. These days, the only thing I see are like various different Australian nationalist symbols that you're using in and around this white Australia ideal.
We are open national socialists. We venerate Adolf Hitler. We celebrate.
You go to court for throwing Romans. I get that, but I just wonder how many people are ready to like move on and just listen to what you have to say. Instead of just yelling Nazi is not going. That's not a debate. Just yelling Nazi when you're proposing various different things that people agree to is not really workable anymore. I don't believe. If you guys are out there doing cartoon stupid stuff like something out of Hollywood, but you're not doing that. You're showing up to popular things where people are pissed off and you're agitating very successfully.
I'm very proud of our activism over the past year in particular, because what we have done is we've consistently taken up issues where the people are on our side, but where no one in the political establishment, even the so-called populist right elements of the political establishment, are willing to actually fight. And we go, okay, we'll take up the fight then. And by doing that time and time and time again, there's a lot of conservatives that have to invent conspiracy theories of like, oh, this is obviously like an ASIO or left-wing op to try and like associate common sense patriot positions with the Nazis. And it's like, no, actually, we just care about the country. We're just showing up to fight on the issues that you should be showing up to fight for. It shouldn't have to be us that boos the welcome to country. It shouldn't have to be us that tries to mark on Australia Day. It shouldn't have to be just us that are standing up to Jewish attacks on free speech or, refugee encampments demanding permanent visas and so on, or whatever, all the different issues that we've taken up. It shouldn't be us standing up for the white workers that are getting replaced by immigrants out in country towns, getting bussed in and housed by these foreign multinational corporations that have taken over local industries out there. It shouldn't be us having to take up all these issues. Someone else should be, but no one else is. So it's like again and again and again and again, the public are being exposed, and then the out of touch media and establishment goes, look at these horrible people. We all must condemn them. They all must be put in prison for expressing an opinion that we find offensive. And Australians are like, but that's not how it works. You know, we live in everyone has a right to have an opinion. Who did they hurt? Who did they attack? Nobody. Okay, but how come they're actually making sense? I actually agree with them. How come white people can't do a rally, can't do a march, can't express an opinion without being attacked? But you can have pro-Palestine rallies where they're burning down cities, or you can have – now they're trying to do BLM in Australia where some African runs at a cop with a knife and then gets shot, and now the Africans are race rioting over it and organized by communists, or you've got – African crime waves, Aboriginal crime waves, you name it. You got Indians and Pakistanis fighting in the streets over something that has nothing to do with Australia. You've got all this nonsense going on, and that's all fine. But a white man stands up and says, hey, here's an actual legitimate political issue. And all of a sudden, like, you know, we need to have like 30 or 40% of the resources of our intelligence agencies devoted to stopping these people from doing street rallies. We need them all thrown in prison. The prime minister, leader of the opposition, all the main political talk shows, they all have to come out and condemn them every time they do anything. And it's just we're kind of using their own hubris, their own hysteria against them, basically, to legitimate ourselves. And it's working like a peach.
I would imagine that you're going to see some... you're going to eventually see some right winger try to move into some of these positions just to take your starch away. It's kind of like a controlled opposition move like they do in America, the Republicans. I'm surprised you don't have anything like that there. No one's trying to move into these positions. They're just letting you guys show up and get all the news.
Yeah, I mean, there is an emerging populist right in Australia, but they don't really have dynamic leadership, and they got, you know, a lot of their leaders are out of touch. The only politician that actually is kind of like channeling our energy is Brown. There's Senator Ralph Babbitt from Victoria, who's a Mauritian immigrant, but he follows Nick Fuentes and Andrew Tate on Twitter, and he came out in defense of us, and he calls out the Jews, and you know, he always takes the base position on everything.
He got elected by brown people or something? How did he get elected?
He got elected on the anti-COVID vote.
Okay.
So, he was kind of like campaigned on how the – because this is back 3 years ago when everyone was reeling from – the most egregious lockdowns anywhere in the world in Victoria, the longest lockdowns of any major city in the world in Melbourne, and vaccine mandates and everything.
He gets the Carmel Kingdom, the Carmel Kingdom.
Yeah.
The Carmel Island. Yeah.
But now he basically, I think I'm certain he watches the show, and he basically just copies our talking points and then rehashes them, waters them down slightly, and then puts them out. Or he copies stuff from Andrew Tate. He's posting the N-word on Twitter and all this kind of stuff.
Why is he's allowed a Twitter account, an X account, but none of you guys are. My understanding is that is an Australian policy. That's not like Elon Musk even, but the Australian government did something, correct?
Yeah, it was definitely a high ranking part of the government that got us kicked, because Twitter has not even explained, not even, you know, when you get banned from Twitter, you usually get the email saying this is why you're banned.
Right.
None of us have got that email, and we've like been like, why are we banned?
Can you log in? Can Joel Davis log in? Can you log into Joel Davis X and be like a ghost, look around, logged in, and appeal or anything like that? Or no? Or is the account can't?
Nothing happens. Like, there's just zero correspondence.
You can't log in at all. Can you log into your account still?
I can log in, but like you can't.
Okay,
do
so the account is still there. They didn't delete it out of the system. Your account is still there. It's not active. Okay, so this is typically what they've done to me a few times. The last time it took quite a while to get it back, but I got it back. This is actually somewhat. The only good news is you'll be able to get it back someday potentially. Your ex account. I don't like to see any nationalist assets like that, and I consider all these accounts like assets, where you get stripped of it, which is basically getting stripped of a public utility and a giant platform for propaganda, potentially, at least to agitate other high-end propagandists.
I mean, it's been really annoying because, I mean, the events of the last few months, if I was on Twitter, would have blown up more than ever before, and all of the discourse in Australian politics is kind of like bending under our influence. And I mean, that's why they banned us. We were getting too effective. Like, we reached this critical point where we were at like a liftoff trajectory, where you could see in the numbers, you could see in the virality that we had basically reached a new phase of notoriety and prominence. And they freaked out and they pulled whatever strings they had to get us taken down. And obviously, there's not much recourse that we have. Maybe when we form a political party, we can use that to say, like, look, like you can't ban political accounts that are like part of a registered political party. That's again unconstitutional, because we're trying to communicate the policies and positions of a registered political party to voters. You can't obstruct. You're obstructing Australia's elections and Australia's democracy if you ban us. So maybe we'll be able to use that in the future. But
yeah, it needs to be the free speech issue, the X issue, the Facebook issue, because Facebook is critical here for organizing. I mean, it's like all the Republicans, all the Democrats. Hell, I even think of the libertarians and stuff like that. When they do particular meetings, you sign up and, you know, you get information on Facebook and sign up on Facebook. Like if you're like a Republican politician, I'm thinking of one comes into your area, you can sign up on the Republican, you know, Facebook, whatever, to go to that particular meeting. So it's like become not only for buying and selling things locally, but Facebook has become critical for political organizing, whereas X is somewhat important, if not very important, if you're in some type of political newsworthy type of organization. I mean, you definitely want an X account. So this particular type of thing they do to slow down momentum, it's kind of like yanking bank accounts and stuff like that.
No, just banned from X too. We're banned from YouTube, Instagram, yeah. Facebook, blah, blah, blah. When Blair was taken down off Facebook back in the day, my associate, most people would know who Blair Cottrell is, there was a freedom of information request that then revealed it was the Prime Minister's office that demanded that they were taken down. So like this is the precedent of the fact that high level government are basically trying to silence their political opposition because that was when Cottrell's project, which Tom Sewell was working on with Cottrell, United Patriots Front and the old political party they tried to register called Fortitude and so on, the first wave, I guess, of our movement. We're now in this like new phase, new organizations, new approach. But they were getting too much momentum. They were getting too much notoriety. And so they stifled them in the same way. And then we had to rebuild from ground zero back up. And we built a whole new wave of momentum, this time way more radical, actually. And now this is, again, what they use against us. But we just have to adapt. Like, we have to adapt. And our influence still echoes through politics very effectively, regardless. So it's a stifling thing, but it's not terminal. Like, we are still able to keep progressing and moving forward. We're even getting banned from Telegram. Jacob Hurston's Telegram account was completely just like deleted by Telegram. I've never seen that before. And a whole bunch of our official National Socialist Network accounts and everything, they were all just deleted all at the same time. Like, I've seen app banning. Like, my old Telegram account got app banned, where you can't see it on Google, or if you download the app from Google Play or the Apple Store, and I have to make a new account because most people can't be bothered downloading the app directly from Telegram or whatever to get around it. And that's annoying. And that's happened to Tom before as well, Tom Sewell, a couple times, I think, now. And so that's annoying. But Hurston's account wasn't just app banned. It was like fucking just deleted by Telegram, like as if he was like a terrorist or something. So that's the level of censorship we're dealing with, where even like Telegram is fucking with us. And, you know, we're able to stream on Rumble and Odyssey, I guess, and use Telegram, and that's about it. And we're hanging on for dear life on these platforms. So,
yeah, I know Odyssey's supposedly told me they're going through some type of upgrade where they're going to be using Airwave starting this Friday. It's probably going to be pretty rocky, though. So Odyssey, it looks like, is trying to get back in the game. They're going to go to USDC, but there's going to be a little bit of a gap where they're going to be using Airwave, meaning you're going to be able to support the platform through this particular type of cryptocurrency. And I just don't know how the onboarding or offboarding is going to be, or how complicated it's going to be, you know. Rumble looks like it has the biggest growth. But you guys... I'm curious to see about this particular X ordeal. You would have had the largest account. You probably would be at 70, 80,000 by now, maybe more with all the events and stuff like that. But Tom can't have an X account, right? Blair has been constantly banned off there, and Blair's pretty mild, you know, these days, what he puts up. And, you know, I remember him putting up fitness stuff and things like that and getting banned.
He's just too dangerous because he's just too popular. Like, yeah. I remember when Blair and I started doing the show together, this is a bit over 2 years ago now, and I was like, you know, have a crack on TikTok, like make a TikTok and see how you go. And he's like, yeah, I'll give it a go. And so he just made like three videos of him just filming himself in the backyard talking about his opinion on random shit. And they were just going viral. He got like 2 million views on three random TikToks in like a few days. And they were like, fuck, Blair Cottrell's blowing up on TikTok, and just like nuked his TikTok. But it was like, imagine if he was able to just do that. He'd probably have like a million followers on TikTok by now, because people just like him. He's just likable. So these are the assets that we have. Like, if we run people like that for office, And the Australian people get to see someone like that by contrast to the other options. He's going to get votes. He's going to get a lot of votes.
Are you going to make Blair stand?
The media is only going to empower him more and give him more attention and more support. And that's the hardest thing to do when you're a minor party in politics. Americans don't really understand this as well in your political system because it's so locked into this like two-party duopoly.
Unfortunately, yeah.
But in our system, there's more capacity for minor parties to, you know, get a foothold. Like we're seeing in Britain right now. I don't like the Reform Party, but they're now the biggest party in the polls in Britain. They came out of nowhere, and not really out of nowhere, but they're massively spiked. And the Conservatives are now like the third. They were running Britain for years, and now they're like polling at third, and they're barely able to hold on to any seats if they held an election tomorrow. So that shows there's a bit of dynamism in that our style of politics a little bit more for outsiders to kind of get in and compete. And the most difficult thing for minor parties is getting people to know who you are. And we have that advantage that the people are going to know who we are. Like if you go on the street and you say to someone, name me six political parties, they probably can't. They probably don't even know six. But
those neo-Nazis,
one of the ones that everyone knows very quickly.
How many guys do you think you can actually get? How many guys, I mean, you don't have to reveal it if you don't want to, but I have a feeling that if you guys, when your party comes up, you'll have like a dozen guys standing for some kind of election, at least. I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Our objective would be ultimately to be able to have people standing everywhere, competing for everything. But, yeah, obviously we'll be strategic at first and we'll try and, use a strategy to, like, target the places that have the highest chances of success. Under the Australian system, if you compete, so that in the lower house, it's like in America where, like, the states elect senators as states and then the lower house, you have like more like local regional like electorates that elect individual representatives. But if you can get over 4% in one of those regional elections in a particular seat, the Australian Electoral Commission pay you. So you basically, it's like if you can get 4% of people to agree with you, they'll pay you X dollars per vote. So say you get 8%, you get 9%, you get 12%, you're actually getting good money back from the state, from the taxpayer, to then fund your political campaign for next time. So we're going to obviously try and identify where are the places where we could get more than 4%. If we can get over 4%, we get money, and then we can invest that money in, you know, doubling that and tripling that, and eventually, you know, really being able to compete for those places. But then in the real place where we can probably get people in is in the Senate, because Australia doesn't have that many states. So in America, every state only has like two senators, right, or something. In Australia, it's 12. Every state has 12 senators. That's a lot of senators. So only half of them are up for re-election every election cycle. So it's only six spots that you compete for in every election. But that means that if you're a smaller party, you can get that sixth spot. If you maybe get 10%, 12%, it depends on, because we have a preferential system. But if you can carry that radical, you know, 10%, 15% of the population, you can, in a particular state, you can then use that to then get into the Senate. You can get guys into the Senate. And the Senate has, in a certain sense, more power because there's less members in the Senate. So being a senator, in a sense, is higher profile.
How many senators? How big are the elected houses in Australia right now?
So there's 72 senators.
Okay.
And there's like 140-something in the lower house.
Well, that's not that many in the lower house. I thought you were going to say 250 or something. Okay.
No,
it's not a very big elected body for such a size. Well, the country itself is giant, but the population isn't. They're trying to grow it through third world.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so we'd probably be targeting this. Like, if we're going to get guys in, it'd probably be in the Senate most likely first. So
what about the local level, at the governor level, mayor, governor, that type of thing?
Yeah, well, yeah. So in the
not going to target that at all?
In the state, so competing in state politics is something we're also looking at, because state politics is important because criminal law is primarily done at the state level. So a lot of these hate speech laws and stuff, they're at the state level rather than the federal level. So if we want to attack those, attacking them at the state level is necessary, whereas the federal level is more where you're going to go after like immigration policy and, economic policy and things like that. But yeah, obviously we're gonna compete for every, we want to compete for everything. We want to be like, we think we can actually establish a serious party that's a serious force. And if we can prove it and we can get some results, you know, we think that a lot of resources and support will flock to us, and we can really grow, because there's a massive dissatisfaction in the country, and Australia has the specter of racism hangs in Australia because it's the founding principle of the country. Australia was built on racism, like really explicitly, like what freedom is to Americans, racism is to Australians from a historical standpoint, you know? So, we feel confident that there's a, not that we have, not that we can go rock up and like win government in one election. That's ridiculous. But we know that there's a base that's out there. There's a support that's out there. So,
well, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Even our presence in the system, like we don't even need to win to completely just transform the discourse and have incredible meta-political effect. And there's lots of things that we can gain, like legal protections and so on, we can gain from being a political party that will enable us to function as activists. So,
yeah, that's the big thing, because with a political party, it legitimizes your activism. It legitimizes a lot of political parties have, when it comes to ads over here and when it comes to all kinds of different protections, they have enormous protections. Like a candidate running for office is allowed to have all kinds of different totally different advertising rates and so on and so forth, etc. So there's a lot of advantages. If you can get in, or if you can even just run. What else? So when is your next court case coming up? Did you actually tell us when your actual court case was coming up?
Yeah, so my next court date personally is at the end of May.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact day. It's like 28th or the 29th of May. And I think Sewell faces court at the same time. Sewell has got multiple court dates. He's got they're dragging him through the courts in Victoria, one for a so-called offensive behavior charge, which is ridiculous, for leading a rally like a year and a half ago where we marched through Ballarat in the anniversary of the Eureka Stockade, which is just ridiculous. Then also he's being dragged through the courts for intimidating a police officer, because when we did, if people remember our rallies, we did a couple of rallies with a giant banner that said "fuck off, we're full" on it. That went pretty viral. And that was in relation to basically a refugee encampment where a bunch of so-called refugees, but they're not really refugees, they're migrants, were organized by communists to camp out the front of the Department of Home Affairs and demand permanent visas to stay in Australia. So we rocked up and counter-protested them with a huge "fuck off, we're full" banner, because they were really distasteful. They were chanting things like "no borders, no nations, no deportations," all these communist slogans, and in broken English, like just they're entitled apparently to just live in our country because they exist, and we're a bunch of racists, and the country belongs to the Aboriginals anyway. This is what they were saying, and the media was fawning over them, like, "look at these poor victims." There was one guy who was like Afghanistani. And he was getting interviewed by the media, and he was saying, "I've been here for 12 years. My wife and children are back in Afghanistan. I want to go visit them, but if I go visit them, they won't let me back in." And it's like, how are you a refugee? Your wife and children are back in at home. The war's over now, too. So you just like abandon your wife and children in a war zone, moved here to like drive Uber or something, and we're supposed to sympathize with you? Fuck you, you know? But anyway, at that rally, The second time we did it, because we did it once, it was quite potent, and then they had like a big kind of closing rally, basically. They kind of gave up. And so we went down to rub it in and do it again. But we went down the second time to confront them, and there were heaps of cops there. We all got pepper sprayed in the face. It was a lot of fun. But when we were there, there was an undercover police officer who had a baton who came up to one of our guys and grabbed his balaclava and tried to rip it off, so that the media would dox him or whatever. And that's assault. Like grabbing someone's clothing and trying to like rip their clothing off is assault under Australian law. So he assaulted him. And so that video was then played on national news, and we were breaking it down on our show. And Tom was saying, you know, this guy assaulted one of our guys. in the attempt to try and reveal his identity. Well, we know who he is. We looked him up. We found his social media. We know where he lives. We know his wife. We know his house. And it would be fair for someone to put out his details, is what Tom was saying, to the public and see how he likes it. But then Tom said, but I'll check what the laws are before I do anything to make sure it's legal. I don't want to get in any legal issues, but, you know, maybe it's time we start doing something like that, because these people think they can get away with whatever. They then came, raided his house, arrested him, and charged him with threatening a police officer for literally stating he was going to check the law before he did anything. And just simply that he was going to publish his details, not that we're going to go around his house and like beat him up or something. So now he's getting dragged through the courts for that, as well as these other things, the Nazi symbol thing in Adelaide with me and some of the other boys. And Jacob Herson has got his appeal for the so-called Nazi salute that was illegal that he did. He was found guilty and sentenced to 1 month in prison for that, but he's appealed it to a high court. He intends to kind of keep appealing it if necessary all the way to the high court and challenge it constitutionally. So his court case, I believe, his appeal case in the county court is in July, I think. So anyway, there's a lot of shit going on. There's more stuff than that too, but we're already kind of bored the audience probably with talking about
right,
it.
Right, right. I was just trying to figure out when someone might be going to jail. I'm making a joke.
Yeah, potentially
but you never
soon.
Know.
I mean, obviously Stephen Wells is in prison right now, sure, because he kind of, on a matter of honor and principle, refused to sign bail conditions, signing away his political rights, and so he's already done 3 months in remand prison. So that's admirable, like, to be that locked into his principles. But other than that, no one is in prison right now in the movement. But yeah, a lot of us are facing probably short jail terms or slaps on the wrist that aren't even really going to jail for things that shouldn't be illegal. But yeah, I mean, Jacob got sentenced to 1 month in prison, so if that all fails, he'll probably do a short stint. Yeah.
I'm curious, has anyone ever went after the noticer yet?
Well, the media have gone after the noticer.
Oh, really? Okay. Because I haven't really paid attention or exactly, I don't live in Australia, but I was just curious because the noticer is making waves when it comes to running news reports on what's going on over there. It doesn't matter whether it's breaking news over Bangladeshi student 27 accused of sexually assaulting girl 15, good God, at Bondi Westfield given bail. You know, they're breaking any relevant news to Australia, they're breaking in one way, shape, manner, or form, right?
Yeah, Noticer.news is the best news site in the world. Like, I can't think of one news site that's better. It's incredibly high grade professionally, but also it publishes opinion pieces from really, really sharp opinion pieces. I mean, obviously it's focused on Australian news, but they do cover international stories as well. And they've only been active for like 14 months and they're blown up on social media. They've got better social media metrics than any of the mainstream news outlets in Australia.
That's because they're telling the truth and they're talking about issues that the public wants to know about. How have they been attacked, though? I'm just curious on how the media in Australia would handle competition like this. Let me go to their X account because I know
the national broadcaster, the ABC, which is like the BBC of Australia. Yeah. They're like literally funded by taxpayers. They ran multiple hit pieces on them recently, accusing them of being a neo-Nazi propaganda front and quoting me saying that they're one of our biggest weapons and we're forming a political party and you need to have media support in order to do that. And the Noticer is like our propaganda arm. They're not connected to us in any official capacity. They cover us extensively and well, and they publish my opinion pieces, but that's the extent of.
Has the editor been exposed? Had they been doxxed at all? Anything like that? Or
no.
Okay. All right.
No. But
it's good.
They tried to say this nonsense in the news the other day when they were talking one of these articles about our intent to form a political party, and they have all these so-called right-wing extremism experts, which are like Marxist activists that are given all these bullshit titles to go and give official expert opinions in the news. And they brought up the Noticer as well, and they said, oh, the Noticer is a front of the National Socialist Network, and they're using the same web hosting service as the WhiteAustralia.org website. So that's how you know that it's the same. Like, what do you mean? Like, so if two people use, like, Amazon Prime hosting services, it means they're in the same group? Like, it's just, like, insane disinformation.
Yeah.
Like, they use one of the mainstream hosting services that, like, millions of websites use. Like, is every single website a Nazi because we also used it? It's ridiculous. But these are the kinds of things that we deal with in the media here. But it doesn't matter. No one cares. When the ABC attacked the Noticer, multiple sitting politicians came out in defense of the Noticer because they attacked. They were like, this neo-Nazi propaganda outlet keeps getting retweeted and reposted by all of these, like, senators and members of parliament and election candidates and so on. And the right wing defended it. Populist right is getting better in Australia. They're defending us and things adjacent to us more and more, and they're not allowing the cancel culture of the left to cuck them anywhere near as much as they did a year ago or 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And that's one of our main objectives, is to get them to realize that we're all on, like, to play as a team. Let the right wing play as a team. Yeah, we're more radical than you, but we're on your team. And they attack us, it's an attack on you. There's no point joining the chorus of the left against us. You're just increasing their cultural and political power at your own expense. The left use their communist radicals to attack us. The left don't cancel their own radicals. So stop canceling us and use us. Look at how we're the most metapolitically effective activists in the country of any political persuasion. Use us. You know? Just let us cook. Just don't punch right, basically.
This is exactly what the Noticer does very well. It's this, some of it's subtle, some of it's not so subtle. New scheme to stop third world trolley dumping in immigrant-dominated Sydney suburbs, which is pretty funny, and I'm sure this just infuriates their particular headlines, how they do things. I don't even know what this is about, but it's about trolley dumping. The council was previously spending $800,000 on landfill every year to deal with the problem. Holy cow. They're dumping shopping trolleys, third worlders.
If you look at the metrics on Noticer, the articles that do the best of everything they cover are either stuff on our activism or immigrant crime.
Right.
That's what the people want to hear about. They want to hear about Nazi activism, and they want to hear about immigrant crime, and they want to get angry about immigrant crime, but justifiably so.
Bangladeshi.
And Aboriginal bullshit. So it's like they say, oh, they're promoting propaganda. It's like they're just reporting on the news, and there's a bunch of people in Australia that have emotional reactions to that news because it's important news that you don't report on, or if you report on it, you conceal the fact of their ethnicity or their race or whatever. The Noticer will just say Sudanese criminal or Indian rapist or whatever, because that's actually what is of interest about the story. The fact that they're a different race is of interest because these people who come here obviously don't have the same values and standards of behavior and tendencies and so on as the white population. And when they commit rape or murder or home invasions or whatever against us, obviously that's of note because it's a direct consequence of the immigration policies of the government, like, and of the anti-white ideology of the system. So they just, as the Noticer themselves said when they responded to the ABC hit piece, they wouldn't be so popular if what they had to say didn't resonate with the people, with the masses, with the common sense patriots out there in the Australian public. So,
yeah, how is this, like, Bangladeshi student 27 accused of sexually assaulting girl 15 at Bondi Westfield? How is this reported in the mainstream?
Look it up.
If at all. What? I'm just curious. When you first heard this, did you hear it from the mainstream or did you hear it from the Noticer?
I mean, I heard it from the Noticer, but to be fair, I do kind of get my news from the Noticer, so.
Okay. All right. I was just, you know.
The mainstream would have written an article about it, but they wouldn't have mentioned in the headline that it was Bangladeshi.
Exactly.
The age difference. And also, like, in the article, they'll put at the end, well, you know, so he gets let out on bail, but Stephen Wells is still in prison, you know, like, or so they'll put some shit like that in there. Maybe that's a bit much for this article. I haven't read this article in particular, but it's just ridiculous that, you know, people can sexually, immigrants He's not even a citizen. He's like on some kind of temporary visa. He can assault an underage girl in public, and he's let out on bail because the judge is worried about his ability to support his wife. Deport this motherfucker, you know. But so that's the concern. But Stephen Wells, he marched around on Australia Day with a cross patch on his arm, and he's being held in prison without even being found guilty. So that's justice in 2025 Australia. But this kind of these stories, this kind of injustice narrative or whatever, it's very popular with the people, you know, because people have a very strong inner sense of justice. And then what Notice it does is it shows how the total injustice with how people like us are treated. And then also at the same time, the ridiculous leniency of the system towards immigrant crime. And it shows the anarcho-tyranny to the people. And the more that it exposes it, the more it radicalizes, you know, conservative, populist right-wing types to just drive the conversation in a direction that is more amenable to real nationalist politics. So it's a fantastic service.
Yes, that's for sure. What do you have to support? We're going to go off here in about 10 minutes. What all do you have that you want us to know about to support potentially? You've got White Australia, which you're working on, a party. The Give, Send, Go obviously is important. What was the Give, Send? Oh, here we go. The Give, Send, Go. There's one for Stephen Wells, but here's the one for you guys.
There's one to help support Stephen Wells so that he can keep paying the bills while he's in prison. And then there's the White Australia one to help us. Fund a few things, but primarily get some resources together to fight these court cases, particularly the high court challenge, which, you know, if we were just fighting court cases for the sake of trying to keep ourselves out of prison, we wouldn't ask for money. We're only asking for money because we want to fight. We're fighting it constitutionally. We're trying to establish constitutional precedent or a high court precedent that can defend our political rights for all Australians. So it's a political fight. It's not just, oh, poor us. Like, we don't care about going to prison if we have to. Like, I'll go sit in a jail cell and do push-ups and read Schopenhauer for a few months if I have to. I don't really care. But it's about fighting it constitutionally. It's about trying to, you know, protect free speech in Australia. So that's what you're donating to. You're donating to a political fight, not to a sympathy party for people who don't want to go to jail. We know the risks. We're not afraid of jail, and we don't demand support on that basis of, please help us buy lawyers so we don't go to prison.
Like, have you guys had any problems getting lawyers? I've heard you complain about it.
There has been
much.
Problems, yeah. We have lawyers, but we try to only use lawyers that will work for free if we can. But in Australia, they have legal aid, so you can get government support to help you pay for lawyers if you're under threat of going to prison and you're not a wealthy individual. But so we try to do it on the cheap. We try to do everything on the cheap because we don't want to waste people's money and resources that could otherwise be put to more productive ends. Because you can waste a lot of money in the court system and you don't get much return on that investment. But if we want to go to the high court, you need to have barristers. You need to have high level lawyers. And even the barristers that are willing to, you know, do it at a cost, basically for costs rather than, like, you know, making a profit. They've got a lot of costs. They've got to pay clerks. They've got to pay fees. There's court fees and so on, and the costs still mount up to very serious money. So even a lawyer that's willing to, or a barrister that's willing to help without really turning a profit on his time, it's going to cost us. So that's why we're raising cash. But yeah, we try to be prudent with people's money as best we can. We don't want to waste it. We're in a political fight. We're not trying to solicit sympathy for personal plight. So, but yeah, that's basically our philosophy. Obviously, when we build the political party, we're going to be trying to do a lot of fundraising for the party so that the party can have, great campaign resources, and a lot of resources are going to get put into all the campaign materials, you know, paying people to work full time, you know, on admin and campaigning and things like that, so that, we can get the message out to the community. there's a lot of graphic design and things like that. But, you know, we're handling that in-house. The reason why we haven't launched the party yet is because we're working on the graphic design. We're working on the logos. We're working on, you know, the core policies, everything like that. So that when we launch, it launches as a complete package that we're not going to just make it up as we go along. We want it to launch, be professional, slick, clean, well thought out, complete. So that when we come to the people and say, okay, now we've got the party, it exists, come and sign up. It's already kind of like formed in a very professional format. We could have rushed it to try and compete in the current election, but it would have been slapped together. It wouldn't have been as professional. We wouldn't have done as well. And we decided we'd rather do it slow and do it properly and professionally rather than rush it and have like a half-assed job, which a lot of the minor parties in Australia are like that. They've got half-assed policies, half-assed campaigns.
Yeah.
Not great aesthetics. And it's no wonder they don't do very well with the people, because if you're expecting people to back a new project, you're going to have to present yourself as being more modern, innovative, slick, clean, professional than your opposition. You have to, if you can't beat them on legacy branding and money, you have to beat them in other areas. So.
Well, it's going to prove to be interesting. Is there anything else you guys have coming up immediately? I know you're active. You've got stuff going on every week, all your different clubs and stuff. Anything you want to talk about? Or?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the organization continues on. Like, we meet regularly for various reasons. I'm not legally allowed to associate with the organization. If you want to get involved and you're an Australian citizen, like I said, whiteaustralia.org. Sign up as a member if you want to get vetted to be organized in real life. And we got things planned this year. We want to put on events. We obviously got, we're going to do more activism. There's nothing immediately coming up in the immediate vicinity for people to come along to or whatever. But
are you guys still having a problem processing all the applications? Tom was, last time he was on the show, he was saying he was like buried in applications. Maybe it comes in waves after publicity. I don't know.
Yeah, after Australia Day, we got a lot of signups because we were so publicized all over the media. And that was part of the reason why they banned us off Twitter. They were like, oh shit, these guys are recruiting too quickly. So, but yeah, we've tried to streamline some internal processes, so hopefully the backlog is more under control now. But if you have any issues, if you're trying to sign up and you're not getting a response, reach out to me on social media or something, and or someone else that's publicly facing in the organization, and they can help you.
Yeah, and
we've got some more stunts planned. You know, the election's coming up this weekend. We've already done quite a few stunts, but maybe there's one or two more we could do.
Yeah, so. I have Joel's bio link up in the description. I find it's the easiest because it covers everything for you for the most part. The only thing you don't have on there is the White Australia, whiteaustralia.org, but put that on too. But you can definitely get a hold of Joel at any of these places. Are you going to be writing for Substack anytime soon? You going to start writing?
Yeah. I've been working on a few different things. Obviously, I had essay debate with Keith Woods a couple months ago. So you can read that essay. A kind of robust defense of like why I think National Socialism needs to be rehabilitated. It's not an argument for why you should personally identify as a National Socialist, but it is an argument for why National Socialism needs to be rehabilitated, because the qualities contained within National Socialism, which are decisive, need to be rehabilitated. And I don't think you can just slap a new label on them and expect no one to notice. I think you actually have to do the work of rehabilitating National Socialism itself if you want to be able to actually, you know, imitate National Socialism in at least many of its most core elements and qualities. And
I find that there's so many historical lies told, and that's one of the problems in the social space. There's zero trust. There's too many lies. And everyone's got their own, like, pet. It seems like every person, especially on the right wing, maybe even some on the left as well, has their own little pet project, their own little beef over something that is a lie put out in history. And there's, you know, Second World War is one giant One giant
Yeah,
lie.
that article doesn't really talk about the Holocaust, though. I barely even mentioned the
Well,
Holocaust.
I'm
It's
not even.
more.
I'm just. There's so many different places to go into in World War II besides even the Holocaust. You know what I'm saying? There's just so many
Of course.
mistruths. There's so much
Yeah, the primary
dishonesty.
argument I decided to make in that article was to not try and do like a let's try and like do apologia for all of the supposed crimes of the Germans. It's not written for that audience. It was written for a nationalist audience. It was making the a few core arguments. Argument number one is that nationalism is just an idea. It's not an ideology. Nationalism is an idea that can be mixed with other ideas. And in my view, that's been a problem. Nationalism, because a lot of people say, oh, Joel, you're an Australian. Why don't you just be an Australian nationalist and emulate your forefathers? And obviously I take the Australian nationalist tradition seriously, but the Australian nationalist tradition was liberal. It was a liberal nationalist tradition. And most countries, most Western countries have a liberal nationalist tradition that existed prior to the Second World War.
Yeah.
And then, so the second part of my argument is that whilst at one point in history, you could mix nationalism and liberalism together and we could preserve our people and our stock underneath that admixture, the post-World War II international order does not allow for that. Liberalism and nationalism have become opposing and contradictory. And I use kind of Schmitt's dialectical argument. I draw upon that to make that case that the core idea of liberalism is essentially defending minority rights. And the core idea of nationalism or democracy in the Schmittian sense is asserting the will of the majority. And that these two are actually fundamentally incompatible ideas, that they liberalism and nationalism were able to forge an alliance against monarchy and the old world, the old order, the ancient regime.
Look at America, how liberal it was, and it passed a northern, not just like an Aryan immigration policy, but a northern European immigration policy. It was completely liberal.
Exactly. Yeah, in the pre-World War II international order, these contradictions hadn't been raised to the surface, but National Socialism raised them to the surface, and the reaction to National Socialism, because National Socialism, I argue, is the purification of the nationalist idea. It is the nationalist idea stripped of all other ideological association. You just take nationalism and you just distill it down to its core principles and then build it back up. That's what you get. And so because the liberal world order came into a kind of confrontation with that in the Second World War and in trying to justify it in the kind of construction of the post-World War II international order, liberalism internally turned itself against nationalism. And so now that old alliance between liberalism and nationalism is no longer viable. Liberalism has realized nationalism is its enemy. And we have to realize that liberalism is now our enemy as nationalists, even if at one point
or
it wasn't.
Or maybe liberalism, in my opinion, liberalism realized the white race was its adversary.
Well, yeah. Same thing. I mean, my nationalism obviously mean like a racial nationalism.
Our nationalism, because there's plenty of nationalists on the planet that they don't give a shit about. But us, I don't know. Anyone white?
Well, I don't think they're nationalists. I think what a nationalist is someone who cares about like the racial stock of his own people. Like that's the core defining trait of a nation.
Would think.
And it's an abuse of the English language to define the nation in any other way. A nation is a people who share ancestry, fundamentally. It's also people who share language and culture and, you know, ethnicity and things like this. But fundamentally, it's a people who share ancestry first and foremost.
They look alike.
Yeah. We have to be related to be of the same nation. So, yeah, the and nation and race were used interchangeably in the English language somewhat in, like, late 19th, early 20th century. And in the Chinese language, nation and race have they don't have separate words for these two concepts. They use the same word, for example.
Yeah.
So that's the classical traditional meaning of the term. But yeah, so I make that case, that dialectical case, that National Socialism is the purification of the nationalist idea. And insofar as we want to preserve our people, we have to kind of recognize that it's kind of our dog in the ideological fight. Now, of course, if you're a Polish nationalist, you're probably not going to want to embrace National Socialism because of the particularities of your historical experience. But what I make, the third argument I make is that Germany has a unique historical role in Western civilization, in modern Western civilization, in the sense that Germany was the most prominent state that rebelled against the Enlightenment, that resisted the Enlightenment, that advanced the Romanticist kind of high cultural resistance to the Enlightenment, and ultimately the political resistance to the Enlightenment, both in both world wars, but particularly the Second World War. And that Europe's destiny in the 20th century was to be ruled either, to be dominated either by Germans or by a mixture of, the Americans and the Soviets. And my argument is that out of those three options, if you care about the preservation of the white race, clearly a German-run Europe would be far preferable to those other two. And in fact, you could even maybe argue that a Soviet-run Europe was less was less destructive to our race than an American-run Europe, because there wasn't demographic replacement in the same way in Eastern Europe as there was in Western Europe. And Eastern Europe wasn't turned into like a suicidal self-hatred by Soviet ideologists as what American Judeo-American ideologists have done to Western Europe. So given those three options, I think, you know, if you're looking at it from a realist standpoint, from a world historical standpoint, it's a great tragedy that the Germans lost the war. So even if the Germans did commit crimes, I didn't want to get into the debates about if the Germans committed particular crimes against the Poles or the Russians or whatever. War's brutal. Everyone was doing brutal things to everyone. The deeper point is who was actually carrying, who was the avatar, who was the vehicle, the world historical vehicle for the preservation of the white race. It was clearly the Germans. And so therefore, whatever their particular historical crimes, in the grand scheme of things, we should look to the German cultural, political, philosophical development from the late 18th to the early 20th century keenly, because the Germans were they weren't even a unified nation. They got run over by Napoleon. They had the Russians in the East threatening them. They had the British Empire encircling them. And they had to hunker down and develop a robust and profound national consciousness. And all the Germans had the greatest philosophers of the 19th century, of the modern world, I would say. They had the most profound high culture, and it fundamentally apexed upon coming to a kind of racial and national self-consciousness and a rejection of the universalism of the Enlightenment, primarily driven out of Britain and France, and ultimately America. So I think we have to look to the Germans for philosophical leadership. That doesn't mean that we should, that I think like German people should rule over all other groups in the world and be, or necessarily or whatever. I do support all the preservation of the white race. And I even say in the article that at that time, Nordicist racial science, this was before advances in genetics, where we now realize that Slavic peoples, so-called Slavic peoples and so-called Germanic peoples are a lot more closely related than we previously realized. And I don't think we should be antagonistic towards Slavic peoples or subjugate Slavic peoples or anything, but we have to put history in context. We shouldn't also be punishing Germans or whatever for these historical crimes, like a bunch of leftists trying to relitigate colonialism and imperial wars of aggression and all this gay shit. Instead, we should realize, what do the Germans have to contribute to us philosophically and politically? A lot. And National Socialism was the only modern political movement that solved the Jewish question, and that totally secured, that was, it offered a vehicle to totally secure not just the German race, the German people, but the European race if they were victorious. And when they occupied France, France was already bringing in Negroes and shit from their empire before World War II. France was like the first to start capitulating to
the noble savage Rousseau
contamination.
Rousseau, the noble savage, the whole nine yards.
And the Germans go in, they occupy France, and they start deporting the Negroes and deporting the Arabs and shit out of France. They were cleaning the French, their country up for them. They weren't going, if the Germans had won World War II, they weren't going to open Europe's borders to non-whites, like, obviously. Like, who's arguing that?
No.
So, the Poles can complain about this and that or whatever, but at the end of the day, the white race was not being threatened by the Germans. It was being threatened by the Western powers. So me as an Anglo-Saxon who had family who fought against the Germans in World War II for Britain and Australia, I see that as the great historical mistake that when we analyze as Anglo-Saxons our history, the British Empire, the great mistake of the British Empire, the terminal fatal mistake was to not make an alliance with Hitler's Germany. So when I'm relitigating the history of my people and trying to come to terms with where it went wrong for us, that's where it went wrong. We should have allied ourselves with the Germans. We should have listened to the Germans philosophically and politically and embraced more of their ideas rather than turned against them and built our society around a repudiation of Nazism and National Socialism, which is what we live in now, and it's a fucking hellscape. So to me, that's the pure position, the logical position.
Yeah, we're going to leave it there, and we'll have you back on again in the future, and we wish you the best. You guys can get his links in the description and definitely support Joel Davis. When are you guys streaming next? Are you streaming? I know you stream early in the morning here, but when?
Yeah. Blair and I will be doing a show this week, so usually Thursday night Australian time, so like Thursday morning, I guess, for the Americans. We'll probably go live.
Okay.
And there's an election coming up this weekend, so it should be a fun stream. There's a lot to digest and dissect.
Okay.
So you can find us on rumble.com/Joel Davis.
Yeah, you guys can get it out as bio link in the description. And I do appreciate you coming on, Joel, and being a good sport. And stay safe over there, okay?
Yeah, always love coming on, Tim. Thanks, thanks for having me.
Cheers, man. And thanks, guys. Nick Bodd, thank you very much for the super chat. And I think it was Aaron White. If I missed something, I apologize. I'll be back Wednesday at 5:30. Cheers, guys. And stay safe out there. Cheers, Joel.